Welcome to Life on Less Meds, a podcast that reveals the truth about drug side effects and the best strategies to manage them. And now your host, Dr. Josef Witt-Döring.
I'm Dr. Josef Witt-Döring. Today I'm joined again by Peter Gordon, Dr. Peter Gordon here, psychiatrist who was injured by Paxil or Ceroxat, depending on where you are, and who has nothing to lose. You know, he's retired and can now lob bombs, you know, safely from his retirement, and does so in a really informed way. And the topic of discussion today is it's really about pharmaceutical industry influence and how it has and how that interacts with key opinion leaders. So these are academics. These are the people that teach the psychiatrists. They're, you know, the professors at the universities, and how that relationship results in overprescribing, essentially, or maybe the under-recognition of side effects. And me and Peter started talking about this not so long ago when there was actually, an article published in a prominent journal. I think Mark Horowitz was involved in that, James Davies, and they were talking about, I think it was actually kind of a big position piece written by multiple different very well-known people, and they were talking essentially about needing to curb antidepressant prescriptions in the UK. And Peter had been sending around a really excellent article on that, which we're going to go into, which he was hoping to get published alongside. And it kind of goes into all of these reasons why overprescription is happening, you know, and how key opinion leaders are involved in that. So that's the introduction. That's what we're going to be talking about. Peter, I'm going to hand it over to you, and I'm going to let you start kind of wherever you liked, because we're going to pick apart this whole issue.
Oh, thank you, Joseph. It's nice to talk to you again from rainy Scotland. So I will definitely come. I think the main focus should be, I wrote a piece recently called The Influence of Paid Opinion Leaders on the Prescribing of Antidepressants in the UK. And this was in response to the letter that Joseph has just described that was in the BMJ. It was a letter called, we could put links, I guess, at the foot of this when this post is. It was a letter called Reversing the Rate of Antidepressant Prescribing. And I submitted a response to this, as I said, about paid opinion leaders in the UK. Why don't I start here then? And I'll come back. I had a slightly different start, but that doesn't matter. Let's start with this because it's very recent. So this, you'll see here, I submitted two responses to the BMJ. And this was in January of this year, 2024. Related to this letter, reversing the rate of antidepressant prescribing. And I'll just do this off the top of my head. I was very keen to do this because I saw that this letter, and people should have a read of it and make up their own minds, but it attracted a lot of responses in the BMJ. And the BMJ is really a good journal. It's a very good journal. And it has a wonderful interface called the Rapid Responses, which I've been part of for many years. Less so in my retirement. So I submitted a response on the paid opinion leaders, and I had to divide it into two parts because the maximum is 600 words. So my first response was setting the scene, and the second 600 words was providing a narrative over the last 30 years of how the paid opinion leaders have had a role in influencing prescribing of antidepressants in the United Kingdom. And that came to about 9 bullet points. All of the material was taken from published research or from the public domain. Nothing from websites or blogs or anything like that. It was all from printed material, published material, and all from the public domain. But unfortunately, the BMJ replied to say that I'm very supportive of the BMJ, but they responded to say they didn't have the resources to check my response, which I'm kind of gobsmacked given that I've had a lot of my material that I've submitted to the BMJ published before without a problem. So I published it on my website, as you've just seen, which is called Holusia, and we'll put the link to that. I replied to the BMJ as follows. I said, I'm naturally disappointed that my recent responses may not be published online by the BMJ. However, I do believe that this is a very important topic, and will continue to do my best to maintain a high profile for the issue of competing financial interests. So I'm very grateful to Joseph today for having the opportunity to do this, and would encourage you, if you share my concerns or you share the evidence, and it is evidence that is in my blog, which I'm not going to go into detail today. I'm just going to give you the brief introduction. If you think it's important, please share it as widely as you can. Because for whatever reasons, and it may just be resources of the BMJ, it concerns me that they have decided not to publish my responses, whereas they've published, as far as I can see, all the paid opinion leaders' responses, some of whom, and I have evidence of this, who have failed to declare in their submission that they were actually paid opinion leaders. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is how I began my response. I said, I see that there have been a number of responses to this letter reversing the rate of antidepressant prescribing. I worked as an NHS psychiatrist for over 25 years, and as part of my continuing medical education, regularly came across the work of a number of respondents. In fact, a good number of them. So this is the law of the few. There's some very well-known names in British psychiatry who have had a career-long paid partnership with industry, who educate British psychiatrists, particularly on prescribing of psychiatric drugs. So I continued, British psychiatry is heavily influenced by opinion leaders who are often paid by industry. These opinion leaders are in positions where they can significantly influence prescribing of psychiatric drugs. Furthermore, this group determinedly shape and form the overall narrative, arguing that they are free from ideology. You frequently see this. They say they're providing evidence over ideology, whereas completely ignoring that there is evidence shown that being a paid opinion leader can and does indeed bias the outcome of the material published. Yet the exact basis of their joint working is generally opaque. This may reflect a wish to maintain a position of medical authority. Psychiatrist definitely wants to maintain that. That comes from science that is perceived as independent from outside interests. And my final paragraph was, in October 2018, the editor-in-chief of the BMJ, Fiona Godley, said, and this is her words, published in the BMJ, "We don't let judges or journalists take money from the people they are judging or reporting on. We shouldn't let doctors do this either." I would carry that over to academics as well, scientists. "Paid opinion leaders," she said, "are a blot on medicine's integrity, a blot, and we should make them a thing of the past." So that was written 6 years ago. But I put at the end of my piece, "However, the paid opinion leaders who generally control the narrative in relation to psychiatric drug prescribing in the UK continue to be very much of the present." So I'm hoping today, Joseph, that we can maybe talk about that.
Yeah, I just love that. I mean, I think that's such a good place to start, because what are we talking about today? You know, we're talking about cash going from pharmaceutical companies to academics and in universities for talks or for assistance running to clinical trials, and how these people in positions of power shape the medical education. They shape the, you know, what goes into the journals. They shape what doctors think are the positions that they ought to have on things, and how that all works. And so I think that was such a great introduction, Peter. Let's walk us forward. Start untangling this web for us. How does the money and this relationship start to corrupt medical education?
It's a good question. And the first thing I would want to stress is I don't think paid opinion leaders, that general term, are bad people. They are just earning money they've decided to earn money from the pharmaceutical industry. I'm just arguing that the basic principle of transparency is a necessary and essential one for science. And we shouldn't feel guilty about asking for that. Nobody's blaming them. If they feel bad about this, they should surely be supporting sunshine legislation across the world, the Western world, the wide world, to make sure that all payments from industry, whether it's to individual doctors, academics, scientists, lecturers, members of esteemed colleges, that they have to declare these. And the same for payments to universities who do the bulk of research, particularly in psychiatry, I'm sure in other areas.
Yeah. So people can follow this on, sunshine legislation is in the US, and you can go to propublica.com, or it's dollars for docs over here, and you can see exactly how much money went from a pharmaceutical industry to a specific doctor. It lays it out per year, and at least that gives you some kind of metric on, okay, what are the relationships like between this person and the different companies? So that's something that happens in the US, but not in the UK right now, correct? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. When I was still working as a doctor, I spent probably about a decade of my life campaigning for sunshine legislation, a law to be introduced to Scotland to make it mandatory for all payments to be disclosed. But I wasn't successful in my petition through the Scottish Parliament. But that's another story. Mm-hmm. But back to today, if the viewers forgive me, I can talk quite well about Scotland and the UK, but I can't talk in such an informed way about wider world. But the parallels here are very strong. So I want to focus on about who should we be blaming for this? Should we be blaming at all? Or who should we be focusing? And the focus is often on the pharmaceutical industry. But I would like to, now that I'm retired, I would like to focus on my profession. And that would be medicine generally, because this doesn't just apply to psychiatry, it applies to all aspects of medicine. But because I was a psychiatrist, I know most about psychiatry, and I had most of my communications with the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And I would like to look at what they have done, I take a long gap here, or haven't done, in relation to this matter about ensuring, just at the most basic level, ensuring transparency about the involvement of industry in psychiatry and how it influences prescribing in psychiatry and how it's done that for more than 40 years. So, mm-hmm. I just need to do a wee explanation. Over the years across the world, we've found that medicines prescribed based on short-term evidence real world experience has shown that there's been harms related to those medicines based on longer term evidence. And in the UK, there was an inquiry set up many, many years ago, probably about a decade ago it started, called the Cumberledge Review. That's after Baroness Cumberledge. And it was for the Independent Medicines and Medical Devices Safety Review, it was called. And it was published nearly 4 years ago. And I want to read out. So the three medicines they were looking at were at Primidos, well, three interventions, Primidos, sodium valproate, which is epilepsy, but also used in has been used in psychiatry quite extensively, and mesh surgery for pelvic floor prolapse. But I just want to concentrate on the general, on the summary of what Baroness Cumberledge said when she presented this to the UK in July 2020. And they're just very short paragraphs, but I'll read them out. Baroness Cumberledge: I and members of the review team have conducted many reviews, and we all agree we have never encountered anything like this. The intensity of suffering, the fact that it has lasted for decades, and the sheer scale. This is not a story of a few isolated incidents. And I'm going to argue very strongly that this is the case for many prescribed psychiatric drugs and interventions. She continued: over the past 2 years, we found ourselves in the position of recommending, encouraging, and urging the system to take action that should have been taken long ago. So this was 4 years ago she said this. The fact is, the healthcare system does not know the scale of problems we are asked to investigate. It is flying blind. This is UK. And then she went on to say, the healthcare system fails to acknowledge when things go wrong. That's definitely been my experience. It fears blame and litigation. Mistakes are perpetuated through a culture of denial, a resistance to no-blame learning, and an absence of accountability. She went on to say, I want to conclude by summarising 9 major recommendations. Taken together, these are wide-ranging and radical. So the Cumberledge Review made 9 recommendations, including 1 which was the introduction of sunshine legislation. But all the recommendations, if you read them, make, I think from a detached viewer or reader, you would say these make common sense. You know, they're not whilst they're radical, they're just common sense based on principles of science. She said, our recommendations will improve the lives of people who have been harmed and make the system safer in the future. Surely that's what we all want. We all want interventions that improve our well-being, but if we learn that there's harms based on over-extrapolation of short-term evidence, perhaps biased by the pharmaceutical industry, which I would argue strongly, we want to learn from this so we don't repeat it again. It's learning lessons, isn't it? And she said, this report must not be left on a shelf to gather dust 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Her final sentence, implementation needs to be approached with a new urgency and determination founded on the guiding principle that our healthcare system must first do no harm. And actually, that was the title they chose for the review. First Do No Harm by Baroness Cumberledge. Just type it into Google and you'll see it. And you'll see the 9 recommendations. Now, I'm going to shut up in a minute, but I just want to say, this is the bit where I'm not, I'm not, I, like everybody, I swear inside my head, but I'm a polite person. I don't want to upset people. So I'm not going to swear aloud here, but you might want to insert your own swear words. But I've communicated with the Royal College of Psychiatrists about the Cumberland Review long and weary. The Royal College of Psychiatrists, who leads British psychiatry and endorses all the educational campaigns and all the research, including by paid opinion leaders and universities who receive massive amounts of money, have not made a single response, not a single response, and you can tell I'm angry, to this Cumberland Review, written, published nearly 4 years ago. Not a single response. They haven't mentioned it. They haven't even got close to the recommendations. What is that silence about? What sort of culture of leadership is permitting this willful blindness?
Mm-hmm. I would like to, because I think we're going to go into that on how we have let this happen, because it is a we, it is you and me, it is our profession and our leadership, because, you know, doctors as well. I mean, we should be looking at the research and we should be looking at our leaders, and we don't, and I guess we're not saying anything, or, well, I mean, some of us are, but we're not doing it in a unified voice for change. Before we go into that, you know, I want to give maybe just a brief overview of what I think is happening with paid opinion leaders. And I want you to riff off this as well, because I think I want people to understand my perspective and your perspective on what's on pharmaceutical industry influence. And so so I'm going to start with this. So if you're an academic, let's say you're trying to get to the top of Oxford, let's keep it UK related at the moment. And you want to get that position, really it's contingent upon you publishing a lot and also being seen as an international expert. And usually that means, you know, you go to the US, Australia, other places, and you talk about certain things, and all of a sudden you have enough publications about depression and enough international speaking tours that you have a resume that would allow you to get promoted. Now, in the academic world, there's a few ways to generate a lot of publications and get conference invitations. You could say, maybe apply for grants from the NHS or in the US, the NIH, these public pots of money funded by the government, but they're super competitive. You know, a lot of people are going for them, and they don't pay out that well, and it's hard. And there's other various public places and private places you could go. But what we do know is that the best place to get money for research is really the pharmaceutical industry. So there's something that happens where, these up and coming academics, they have a lot of choices. You know, how am I going to get, you know, how am I going to bolster my CV to succeed? And then a pharmaceutical industry person will come along and say, why don't you help us run a clinical trial? You know, we want to investigate this new drug. You could oversee it at your site. We'll provide the funding for your institution. I mean, the chair of the department will be happy. Not only that, we'll actually write the protocol for you. We'll answer all the questions you have about it. You're not going to have to develop your own protocol. We'll give you administrative staff. We'll handle data entry. In fact, you just oversee it. You bring the patients, and that's pretty much it. At the end of it, we're going to generate about 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 publications. We're going to have them written out for you. We'll send them to you and your friends to review, and that's essentially it. And we may even have you come and speak at some of our conferences so you can talk about the results of this study. So it's like, you know, when you, if you're trying to ascend to the top of the academic hierarchy, and a lot of that's what you want to do, you want to get tenure, mm-hmm. you end up being seduced in many ways by these arrangements because they really bolster your CV. And over time, you get bored. Yeah, over time, because you want to expedite your career, you say, well, maybe I'm not going to say things that are critical about these medications. Maybe I'm not going to make a big deal if they maybe push the envelope too hard in their publications. I want to be seen as a team player. I want to be seen as someone that's easy to work with. And so you kind of go along with that. And I think eventually you start to believe your own bullshit. You start to, you know, the cognitive dissonance begins to grow, and you're just like, wow, you know, I'm really kind of sucked into this narrative now that these drugs are the greatest thing ever, you know. And because that's what the pharmaceutical industry has to do, you know, they have an agenda, a commercial agenda, to make sure doctors view their products in the most positive light. They will always tilt their publications in that way. And so these academics who are in there with them and now have their names on all the publications, they slowly get sucked in, because to realize the opposite, it's almost like, wow, I don't have integrity. You know, I'm not a person of integrity. So I think they let themselves get lulled into this cozy relationship with them to the point where eventually they've been totally groomed. And then when, you know, these disasters emerge over time where some public group will say, hey, you know, these drugs are causing side effects, like the Cumberland report, that these academics, at that point, they're defensive. They're like, no, these drugs are life-saving. These are the greatest things ever. In fact, the people that bring this up, they're Scientologists. They have these biases. They're people who want others to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. They don't really understand mental illness the same way we do. And because they've been able to ascend to the top of their academic posts, you know, through their influence through their relationship with pharma, they actually have a very well-respected voice, because we have a bias that when we see someone who's a professor at Oxford, we go, oh, here's someone who knows something. This is someone who's at the top of a really big institution. We're not going to really question too much how they got there or their beliefs, or maybe even how much clinical work they really do, how connected they are with people. We're just going to assume that they have the right opinions because of the status that post gives them. And so they have this disproportionate influence on the way an entire country or medical system can, you know, view problems. And, you know, because of their position, they can publish things very easily in journals. They really have a huge influence. I'm going to stop there. Peter, I want you to riff off what I said. What did I miss? Is there anything else in there that kind of paints the picture of how this money from pharma to paid opinion leaders ends up, you know, putting them in a place where they can really influence things quite badly? Just riff off that. Yeah.
That's an excellent summary, Joseph. And I know it doesn't apply to all people who are paid opinion leaders, but that process is very much, and we're human beings. These are not bad people, but you just get influenced. You get groomed. You get enticed through. And the thing I would add would be, at least in the UK, and I suspect this is okay, it's there. The one of the previous presidents of the Royal College of Psychiatrists said this was President Wendy Byrne. It's on record, said that most UK psychiatrists are not influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. And I responded to her on my, I responded on my blog to this saying, well, that's true in a way, directly. They're not, they don't work with industry. Most of my colleagues didn't work with industry. I didn't work with industry. But the influence, it comes through paid opinion leaders by and large. And it's a fairly small group, which has been described as the law of the few. So I could, and I will do shortly, riff off about 20 paid opinion leaders in UK psychiatry who are mostly all still going, who many of them have been career paid opinion leaders, whose influence as part of the law of few are regularly involved in educating British psychiatrists of all ages through conferences, through textbooks, through blogs, through Royal College.
Well, I'm gonna interrupt you for a second, because this education that you talk of, I think a lot of doctors see it as education. You know, I'm gonna read something in a medical journal or go to a conference, and you know, it's gonna be a report on a clinical trial, or it's gonna be a rebuttal piece about something. This is, you know, they think of it as education, but a lot of it actually gets generated from industry behind the scenes. And again, there's always, you know, any time it has a link back to industry through the paid opinion leaders who are in a relationship with them, it's actually marketing. Yeah. And so this is the main thing that I think a lot of doctors, and I didn't realize for a long time, that a lot of stuff that you hear in conferences or even in peer-reviewed journals, which are supposed to be objective and non-biased, it's actually marketing. It's an agenda to get physicians to see a drug in the most positive light. Yeah.
I, when I was doing my sunshine look at trying to be an advocate for sunshine legislation, I used to have a banner which said, no marketing in science. Surely that's not controversial. But I'm afraid marketing is extensive in UK psychiatry, which I can talk about confidently. But I thought maybe I'll give one example, and I'm going to, I don't want to just pick on one person because that's not fair. So I'm not picking on, there's one paid opinion leader that's very, very well known in the UK and is known because he had a government role as well, who has been around all his career, and his name, I just want to give this as an example of where money talks. And you can decide for yourself, but I called my post on this money talk, and this is Professor David Nutt. He's a career-long paid opinion leader in psychiatry. Sorry, I'm reading at the moment. It's just from my blog. He's widely known and continues to be extremely influential in relation to the prescribing habits of British psychiatrists. As the UK has no sunshine legislation, we cannot know the scale of payments from industry made to Professor David Nutt in the course of his career. And the payments could be, we can only speculate, but I suspect they will be into the millions, possibly beyond. It is possible, I put in my blog, that he's received similar amounts of money as one of his US counterparts, Professor Stephen Stahl, who we know, as Joseph has described through this, what's Dollar for Docs, that he's received virtually billions from the pharmaceutical companies over his career. So this is Professor David Nutt, and he's still widely respected in psychiatry across the UK. So Professor David Nutt gave the following two statements in published journals 8 years apart. They were both made by him. He was one of the authors. And I've come to the conclusion it's impossible reading these not to conclude that money talks. So in 2014, Professor David Nutt stated in Attacks on Antidepressants, Sign of Deep-Seated Stigma. So this is about 10 years ago. Antidepressants have an impressive effect size in the treatment of acute cases of depression. And antidepressants have an impressive ability to prevent recurrence of depression, which makes them one of the most effective of all drugs. That's very clear, isn't it? So come to 2022, Professor David Nutt has been, for the last 10 years, been promoting, marketing, let's say, a wide range of novel psychiatric drugs. You name it from, you name them. Anyway, this one I think was about psilocybin. So he said in 2022, in a paper called Increased Global Integration in the Brain After Psilocybin Therapy for Depression, even the best performing antidepressant drugs show modest efficacy, non-negligible side effects, discontinuation problems, and high relapse rates, highlighting the need for new improved treatments.
Yeah.
Dear God, why do we trust? If David Nutt is so confident about these, he should make clear, as should all paid opinion leaders in my part, it should be mandatory to make clear what they are paid from industry throughout their career. Every little bit of it. That's transparency. Yet this David Nutt is I would go to say he's a darling of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Cognitive dissonance on a huge scale.
I mean, it's so clear. You see in the first example, I mean, he's towing the party line, talking about how great antidepressants are. And I mean, the whole thing about stigma is interesting because people have used that against me as well, that if you criticize that they're being overused or maybe they're not as great as they say they should be, you know, people start coming at you with ad hominem attacks where it's like, oh, there's just, I mean, you don't like the mentally ill, you want to make them uncomfortable, you don't like drugs and things like that. And so
I'm in there, Joseph, just a second, because you've just sparked thought. Because I agree, I face this all the time, and I've always had the same answer to it. My opinion of any intervention in healthcare, whether it's psychiatry or anything, is any intervention could have a range from good effects to very bad effects, and a whole range in between. Why has psychiatry, and particularly psychiatry, resorted to a very defensive attitude where it attacks people like you and I? I would never say anybody who's benefited from a psychiatric drug that I have no issue with that. I think that's great. I support it. But I want a world where anybody who's had any consequences of a psychiatric drug, good, bad, or in between, to be able to share those without being called, as I've been called, a pill shamer. No, I'm not shaming pills. Or as a demonizer, as of other people, anti-psychiatrists. I see that all the time. I'm so tired of this polarization into psychiatry or anti-psychiatry. No. That's the very basis of stigma. Sorry, I'm passionate about this. That's the very basis of stigma. And the people, psychiatrists, should know better. Stigma comes from, so these are people, we are people like myself, many people who have had bad effects of interventions given in good intentions. But why should we then be stigmatized again by the very people who say they are somehow got a mastery of stigma, how they understand it, they're the supporters of people's stigma. This is wrong. There's some people out there from Royal College of Psychiatrists who should be deeply ashamed, including one or two presidents of the Royal College of Psychiatrists who've actively promoted things like pill shaming tropes, anti-psychiatry tropes, calling people like me Scientology. I don't even flippin' know what Scientology is. Yeah. I'm just an everyday guy.
Yeah.
Sorry, no, I went off.
I'm right there with you. And you know, well said. And to, you know, I want, and to talk about this second paragraph now, which I think is really interesting. Okay, yeah. It's like, you can see, you know, now antidepressants aren't that great, you know, modest efficacy, side effects, discontinuation problems, you know, really not that far apart in time, and highlighting the need for new and improved treatment. It's like his complete position on them has flipped. And I don't think anything's really changed since 2014 and 2022, except that he's kind of warming the market up for psychedelic medicine, which seems like, yeah, now he's kind of being paid to do that. And so, yeah, it's like, what does this person stand for, if not for just kind of what industry agenda is to be kind of pushed at the time?
Yeah. And yeah. Just at this point, I would fair, and this will be my brief bit, because I wouldn't want to isolate Professor David Nutt, and I'm not accusing him of anything. I'm just saying that I'm just commenting on published statements he's made. But in terms of UK psychiatry and the British, I'm really, really disappointed with the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And disappointed is a very mild word. They have done, there's a term in Scotland called diddly squat, which means, basically means you've done nothing. The Royal College of Psychiatrists have deliberately done nothing about this issue, having known about it. So I just want to list through, and it'll be very quick, about how the influence at the Royal College of Psychiatrists level. So just a couple of years ago, the Royal College of Psychiatry editor, and also the editor of the British Journal of Psychiatry, a new editor was appointed. This is a paid opinion leader who's known around the world as a paid opinion leader. No mention of that made. The Royal College of Psychiatrists has a psychopharmacology committee, highly influential in terms of the prescribing habits and the education of British psychiatrists and on the education of British psychiatrists and prescribing. Three times in a row, for a three-year period each, the chair of that Royal College of Psychiatry committee on psychopharmacology committee has been a career-long paid opinion leader. But I'm just going to name some of them because they're out there and people will come across them. Again, I'm not saying they've done anything wrong. I'm just saying that there is evidence in the public domain that these are paid opinion leaders. We just don't know how much they've been paid. Professor Alan Young, Professor Oliver Howes, Professor Guy Goodwin, and Professor David Nutt. Now, Guy Goodwin and Professor David Nutt were on a highly respected BBC investigative documentary series called Panorama. Anybody in the UK will know about Panorama. And the title, this was in 2014, so 10 years ago. And they were the two doctors featured, and they were filmed marketing medicines at a European conference. And the program was called Who's Paying Your Doctor? But the point I'm making here is 10 years on, it had no effect on their future career. In fact, they're still generally considered, and within psychiatry, maybe wider, as the leading experts in prescribing. Mm. I'll just do a few more. Prof. David Baldwin, who started the Defeat Depression campaign, Professor Carmini Parianti, Professor Hamish McAllister-Williams, Professor Linda Gask, Professor Peter Haddad, who was one of the many people along with Prof. Alan Young, who was part of a series of discontinuation conferences fully paid by industry, who, this was many, many years ago, over a decade, who decided to minimize withdrawal effects from psychiatric drugs, particularly antidepressants, and call it discontinuation syndrome. Professor Stephen Laurie, Professor Catherine Harmer, who's about to be the next leader of the British Association of Psychopharmacology. So yeah, that's it. I'm naming and shaming. I'm not shaming. I'm just naming.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that list. And I think the, you know, what's kind of dawning on me is that I think a lot of doctors out there and maybe the public think, you know, Royal College of Psychiatrists, these are, you know, this is the, you know, the group of psych, you know, this is the leadership, the medical leadership who ought to be independent of financial, they should not be taking money from the pharmaceutical industry. They should be the group of doctors out there who really are looking at the patients and the ethics of their profession to make sure that, you know, we're practicing well. But in many ways, it just seems like, I don't know, an arm of the pharmaceutical industry again, because the majority of the people there who are leading it are so kind of bound up in the pharmaceutical industry and drinking that Kool-Aid that this independent group is can hardly be seen to be independent.
Yeah, they're not. And it, like many, you know, the Royal College of Psychiatrists, like the other colleges in the UK, you know, for surgery, medicine, etc., they're described as a charity, which limits how much information you can get from them through things like freedom of information law. But they do receive significant revenue directly from the pharmaceutical industry, as we now know, and it's been reported in the BMJ. But also, they make a huge amount of money, and it is a huge amount of money, from their annual international congress. Now, I should stress to you that the people that are at this annual international congress, which gets thousands of visitors on foot, but also is promoted through other forms of media. But the people who are speaking at that are not paid to speak at that venue. What is important to know is that a significant number, and particularly in relation to prescribing, they are paid opinion leaders who have been paid opinion leaders throughout their career. And those people visiting that venue will not necessarily know that. They won't know the scale of those payments. And when you come down just to your average punter who's goes to your primary care doctor or your secondary care doctor who gets prescribed a drug, there is no way that punter is going to know, wait a minute, my doctor was educated by a paid opinion leader who is probably promoting their latest drug, or who more likely, as you described, present the positives than the negatives, who's very unlikely, as psychiatry has continued to say, is that most of the evidence is short-term by pharmaceutical companies, short-term evidence, 8 to 12 weeks. But the majority of people taking psychiatric drugs take them for much longer than that now. Why is it so wrong to be asking about this? And the Royal College of Psychiatrists have stonewalled this issue. Instead of saying, yes, we agree, there's a lack of good, substantial, long-term evidence, they don't say things like that. They just, so people like me, the best response they do is just ignore us. Mm-hmm. So my plea for people is, watch this, see what you think. I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything like that. I have nothing against the pharmaceutical industry. We will always need industry. There will always be money in science. But let us have transparency. It's not too much to ask for. And then you, your everyday person, can decide yourself. You can look up and say the Royal College of Psychiatrists as a body, how much have they earned? Doctor blah, 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 or academic Y, or researcher B, can look up and say, wait a minute, he earned, like Stephen Stahl, $3 million in 1 year. I think I'll just be a wee bit cautious about taking that advice. But it's surprising the UK has been done so little.
Yeah. And I think the money that someone takes is immediately like a good marker where anyone could look at it and be like, okay, yeah, there's possibly some influence. And so I think that's a great way to see it. I mean, you were talking a moment ago about, hey, the patients, they don't know if their doctors have been educated in this way. But what I see a lot, and I know this because I went through it recently, is the doctors don't even know that they're being kind of educated in a misleading way. And it can seem sometimes, you know, when I've talked about this, like maybe we are conspiracy theorists and things like that, but not so fast, because I think there's probably a pretty relatable analogy that a lot of people will be familiar with if you've worked in corporate environments. And I have, you know, I've worked in several pharmaceutical companies. I've worked in the FDA. I know what corporations are like. And in many ways, medicine is the same. You know, these people at the top who, you know, are there because they've had these cozy relationships with the industry, who have helped them pad their CVs and get there. They're not going to essentially shit talk one another or shit talk industry because they're team players. They're looking to get, you know, things are kind of working out for them. And so they're just going to sort of toe the party line, which is a very corporate. Everyone who's worked in a corporate environment knows, like, you don't just start criticizing people because, you know, even if you're right and it's going to be the right thing for people, because these structures in many ways, you know, there's a lot of self-interest in there. You know, there's a lot of people at the top, and often the sort of the complainers, they get taken out for not being team players. And so the same thing that happens in oil companies and all of these different industries and banking that lead to these terrible situations where it's very clear that, you know, they're not really acting in the interests of the people that they're meant to be serving. I mean, that's the same thing that's happening in medicine. It's this the same kind of pervasive self-interest that leads to these very secretive things and people just saying, hey, maybe we know this is bad, but hey, this is just the way things are done, and just don't be difficult because this is just how we've always done it. And this is just the way the system works, and we're not going to say anything because it's working out well. And that's as exactly uncomfortable as it is, that's human nature in a way.
It is. And it's group behavior. We see it in all organizations, not just in psychiatry. In the UK, we've got an example at the moment of the post office, but UK people will know what I'm referring to, but we won't go into that just now. But I think this sort of group behavior at the top, what we really need is, some people have called me, or people like me, maybe yourself, Joseph, as well, as whistleblowers. I don't like the term whistleblower because I don't believe I'm a whistleblower. They also say I'm brave. I'm not brave. But I think I do have courage to care. And maybe if I hadn't gone through what I've gone through myself, maybe I wouldn't have had as much courage. But I've always been quite an open person. And I've always, if things trouble me, I will voice them. But you're just as you described, if you try and raise them within a system that has understandable self-interest, right? The Royal College of Psychiatrists, you are going to be seen as part of the awkward squad. You're going to be seen, and I was definitely seen as that. And I'm going to name a name here. Somebody I admire, but I have issues with, is Professor Sir Simon Wesley, who was president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, principally during the time when I was trying to advocate for greater transparency. And he was helpful in some ways, but I'm pretty certain, and I can't prove it, that he was effective. And he probably sent round a communication pretty widely, certainly within psychiatry, saying, don't communicate with Dr. Peter Gordon. I can't prove this, but I've heard it from a number of informal sources. So it's just to show you, this is a lack of moral leadership. I understand his position. He's the president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, so he's protecting that. And their interest is the Royal Psychiatrist members. But that's not the same as putting patients first. It's not the same. And I think the Royal College of Psychiatrists, history is going to look back at them for this period of time very poorly. And I would urge them at this point to acknowledge the Cumberledge Review and to acknowledge that harm does happen with any intervention. And this is not about pill shaming or anything. It's about acknowledging that harms can happen and looking at this. And also acknowledging that the evidence base for psychiatry, like in many areas of other medicine, is based largely on short-term studies, many, if not most of which are provided by the pharmaceutical industry. And they can say, oh yeah, we are more objective than other people, but that's not the case. Nobody is more objective than any other people. We all subjective. We just strive towards objectivity. And if we're to strive towards objectivity, we need transparency. We need transparency. It's a basic and vital and essential part of the scientific method. And I keep going back to this because it's important. And we should not feel wrong or be accused of being conspiracy theorists for arguing for this.
It's interesting, you know, because it's where, you know, people look at doctors and they look at, oh, these are psychiatrists, they're physicians, these are objective people. But then there's always the human element that comes into it. And it's like, can you even get to the point of objectivity when your livelihood maybe depends on you not seeing an inconvenient truth? And for many at the top of these groups, their interest is almost promoting, is having a good public image. You know, if someone at the Royal College of Psychiatrists were to say, hey guys, actually, you know, we've got the wolves guarding the hen house. A lot of us here are actually influenced. We've been missing things and hurting people. I mean, it could kill the organization. So to even acknowledge these things, it's like, okay, well, you know, I've messed up. We've all messed up. In fact, everyone kind of here is sort of having lapses in their integrity. I mean, they're not going to see that pretty much. And so they protect their organization. They protect their positions at the expense of other patients. You know, they don't want to see it.
Yeah. Exactly. And it doesn't mean they're bad people, but I think moral leadership is a different thing from being good or bad, that stupid bipolar. I think most of these people, their intentions are good. They got into leadership positions because they want to do the right thing, but it's just exactly as you described, that there are those tensions that stop people bringing changes to the system. But you can bring changes by being more open and honest about these things. And I would argue that it's better to do that when you can, rather than later, because otherwise you get into this habit of hiding stuff, using your expanded media teams to present the rosy picture, not talk about any of the negative stuff. But then at some point you're going to get, and I think this is definitely happening with psychiatric treatments, which have a place and can be good. I wouldn't use the term life-saving, but they can literally save some people's lives. And I'm happy for them that that's been the case, but they can also cause harm. And the Royal College of Psychiatry shouldn't get into a position where they suppress that information, because it'll just make them more and more defensive. And then you'll get statements like Professor David Nutt, which you think, wait a minute, he's saying two completely contrary things. And yet he's our number one scientific leader. And that's just madness. And that's because marketing has infiltrated prescribing.
So here's my question for you, Peter. How come the rank and file doctors don't see this?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I thought about it a lot, because when I was still a psychiatrist and I retired in 2000, I used to talk about my colleagues this a lot, and they said, oh, we never really thought about that, Peter. We just go along to these continuing education things. And I don't have time to look at the bottom of a journal article to see competing interests. And even if you did went to the bottom of the article, competing interests, it would just say worked for such and such a company. It really wouldn't give you an idea about the scale of the bias that could be potentially introduced. So I think it's probably lack of time. The world's full of so much information. Their doctors are respectful people, prescribers, nurses are respectful people. They want to follow the leaders. And it's uncomfortable to ask questions such as this. So I think in terms of healthcare profession relating to mental health, I don't think that there's widespread willful blindness. I just think people just don't want to go there. It's too uncomfortable. They've got enough on their lives. They want to be doing their best right now for people. And I think there's a big thing in terms of humanity wide is we tend to like quick fixes. Short-term evidence is sufficient for, oh, I want to feel better. And you can understand that if you're feeling shit, if you're depressed or you've got really crazy psychotic ideas, you're wanting to feel better, and psychiatric drugs can make a difference here. But the question, that doesn't mean to say that these drugs in the longer term, and drugs that you may find that you've become dependent on, physiologically dependent on you, and you can't stop. We should be explaining to doctors, in my opinion, a very basic thing we should be explaining to people of all areas of medicine is, we've got short-term evidence for these medications that run up to 8 to 12 weeks. The evidence isn't particularly great, but they might make a difference to your well-being right now. But you need to know, it's a leap in the dark about knowing about the longer-term effects of medications, including both the positives and potentially significant harms.
Was that you, Peter, before you got hurt? Were you one of these doctors that was kind of just going with the flow, you know, I'm worrying about my family, I've got my job, things are going kind of fine. And it was just like, yeah, why not trust Professor David Nutt and these other luminaries in my field and my senior colleagues? Do you identify kind of with that prior to tumbling down the rabbit hole with your own drug injury?
Yeah, I'm still stuck on Ceroxat and I'm scared to get off it because it's a hellish drug and it's catching up with me. I'm getting old when I'm only in my mid-50s. I don't want to go into all of that, but I can't stop it because I'm physiologically dependent. And I had a nightmare. This was in our previous interview. I had a nightmare in 2005 and I put my wife and family through hell. And I just I'm terrified of going there. And people have said to me, oh, you don't have balls, Peter. Just try and reduce it gradually over a couple of years. Well, given I've been on this drug for 25 years, I think I would have a hell of a time. But yeah, that was me. I was a junior psychiatrist at the time when Ceroxat, paroxetine, had just recently been licensed for social anxiety. And I went to my GP. I wasn't sleeping particularly well. I had my membership exams, which I passed first time, and had wee babies. And she said, oh, why don't you take this new drug? It's great. You know, it's called Seroxat. It's been licensed for social anxiety disorder. And that's a decision I will regret for the rest of my life. I took it in good faith. The doctor prescribed it to me in good faith. The people promoting it in Europe were two paid opinion leaders, Professor David Nutt and Professor David Baldwin. They're not bad people. They were doing what they thought. They were paid to do their role. But I would think many people who have been on Seroxat, particularly as long as I have, would tell you what hell it's caused our lives. We do our best. I particularly do my best just to not talk about it. I just try and get on with everyday moments as best as I can. I don't sleep. I have urinary problems. All aspects of aging have got worse. I sweat a lot. I get flushed, all these sort of things. And I knew many of those symptoms I experienced from day one. And I thought, oh, well, that's okay. This is going to help my anxiety. I'll probably just be on it for a few months. But when I tried to stop it 3 months later, I thought, flipping heck, I don't feel well. And I said to my wife, who's a GP, I think this has got something to do with Seroxat. And she said, I think so too. And then after that, I started saying to my colleagues, I think I'm physiologically dependent drugs. And they say, ah, don't be daft, Peter. It's not that. These antidepressants are lightweight drugs. They don't cause things like dependence. I said, I'm not addicted to it. I don't want to take it. I said, but when I try to stop it, even when I use it slowly, I feel like shit. And so that's where I began. So that's my background narrative.
Yeah. I feel like there's a real crisis. I mean, I think there is a growing crisis of confidence in our institutions. I think, you know, after 2008, people looked at banking differently, looked at, you know, real estate. And I also think that things are happening in medicine as well now, where it's almost like people are seeing behind the veil. And for a long time, probably in the UK, and definitely in the US, particularly among the boomers, is what I notice in my practice. There's a lot of respect for medical professionals, especially in the older generations. They view them as independent, objective, patient always first. You know, they're not bought. These are people that used to come to my house. You know, these are people that would grind away 80-hour weeks, and they really cared about you. And a lot of people still have that perspective, especially the older ones. And I'm seeing that kind of get whittled away slowly, where, you know, we've got the rise of functional medicine happening now. We have much more holistic therapies. And I think it's because people get the sense that, about what you had mentioned with other doctors, and the US is also takes it a step further, because everyone's in debt when they graduate, sometimes $200,000 to $300,000 in debt. And they end up in these private equity run outpatient clinics where they have 15 minutes for follow-ups, maybe 40 minutes for a new eval. And the patients can feel it. They feel that the doctor is not really invested in them as a person, and that they're kind of getting them in and out. And they go, there's just something not quite right about this. They don't know what it is. Everything that they've heard from their parents and society is like, oh, trust the doctor. The doctor's really objective. But man, it doesn't feel like that down in the gut. It does start to feel like you're kind of just getting kind of churned through a system. And people are waking up to that. And unfortunately, I don't really see anyone many people in my profession of psychiatrists, or even in medicine at large, saying, hey, we're really, we've lost our way. We don't have that same, we were losing our reputation by letting these private equity groups and pharmaceutical companies pull us away from our stated mission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big issue. It's a big issue. And the one thing I would add is, I think I've had, after our last interview, I've had a lot of people get in touch with me saying, oh, I've had similar problems. And I always say the same things. Look, I can't give you any medical advice, and I wouldn't even when I was a doctor, but I can be your friend if you want. But a lot of them say, I've heard quite a lot of times more recently anyway, this is in the UK, oh, my young psychiatrist really gets me, and they finally believe that I've got a problem with dependence and withdrawal from my antidepressant. and they're cool. I got a message from a chap saying that they're cool. So I think there maybe is a change in the younger generations are beginning to accept that there's this issue. And that's down to people like yourself and David Healy and Mark Horowitz and many others, Mad in America, maybe. Mad in UK. Yeah, no, it is. I think
Maybe it's David Nutt who's kind of, ready the market for psychedelic therapies.
Oh, yeah, you might. That's a scary thought. Yes.
Yeah, there's this terrible quote that it's like, science progresses one funeral at a time, right? Where they talk about just the older generation dies off and, things change and the people at the top who were invested in the old way of looking at things have gone, and it kind of opens things up. And what will be really interesting with the psychedelics now is that I think MDMA has its approval date in August, potentially, after the FDA reviews it. They'll have their advisory committee in June. And so what that will mean is, if it gets approved, there's going to be a huge shift in psychiatry in the US, potentially even the world, where there's going to be a new therapy out there where it's not daily meds anymore. It's like, you're going to take this and you're going to do some therapy, and then there'll be a change, and maybe you'll do it, maybe, I don't know, four times a year if you need to, who knows how much you'll do it, but it'll be a big shift. But the thing that I think is going to be most interesting is there's going to be huge commerce surrounding these new drugs. And with huge commerce is going to come a lot of paid opinion leaders who are going to start shit talking the other way of doing things. And that's going to have a huge influence in the way the public starts to see these drugs, because there's going to be a war chest of marketing research, marketing dollars readying the market for this new thing. And I'm going to be really interested to see how the narratives change about psychiatric meds, whether people are going to say, oh my God, you're stigmatizing them when you talk about the negative of at least antidepressants and such. I suspect that might actually go away, because the narrative in the media will change when we have these competing drugs out there.
I think you're right. And it's a bit of a scary future. And, when I started in, when I started in psychiatry, ketamine, this is a different drug, but ketamine was we knew it as a veterinary drug and licensed for anesthesia, and now it's been licensed. And the world is changing, and you're right. Once the old generation, pharma industry will always be looking for a new market, and the bigger the market, the better. And I think what they found, in my very basic understanding, they found that their new medications, i.e. the psychedelics and other stuff, are not better than antidepressants at the moment. But if they say that you've got treatment-resistant depression, why don't you go on to something like psilocybin or ketamine? And I find that whole world quite scary, because I think that world is definitely led by the pharmaceutical industry and by paid opinion leaders. So I think the sooner we get better transparency, the better we are going to be informed as Tremicus savvy consumers. If we're going to be consumers, let us be as savvy as possible.
Yeah. I think you're right to be skeptical about the psychedelics, because there'll be the science and kind of what the science shows. And then there's going to be the whole industry of people that are kind of flogging this stuff in different retreats around the place. And then, obviously the companies as well, who are going to stretch, who will play the same game of, it's like, we need people to see this in the best possible light, and we will push that as far as we can without getting in trouble. And that'll kind of, again, lead to the objective, which is to sell more product. But when they do that, it means that it's not just the people getting the drug who need it. It's some people who don't really need it and end up getting hurt. And we'll probably end up in the same situation that we're in now. Yeah. So, Peter, I think we've covered a lot. What haven't we gotten to that we need to?
I think that's most of the things I've said. Just to mention briefly, to tie up the UK, the UK government are doing a thing about legislation for Essential Sunshine Act, which we don't have like America or France. And it was called Disclosure of Industry Payments to the Healthcare Sector. But they've decided to ignore what's happening in all other countries. And I think, I put in a response, and this could be my last thing I say, really. This is a response I put just in September of last year, 2023. The conflation of marketing with science is costing lives. It is ruining lives. Take just one example, dependence on drugs taken as prescribed, not just painkillers, but also most psychiatric drugs. The cost of the country will be huge and become ever greater as more and more people find themselves dependent on drugs taken as prescribed. This UK consultation, so they've already set the parameters. They gave options, but the options weren't to include essentially what is sunshine legislation. Even if the options are implemented in full, will leave the UK one of the least transparent countries in the world. This is where we need the Royal College of Psychiatrists and doctors shouting up saying, no, this isn't acceptable. We need sunshine legislation so at least we can be a bit more transparent. For a single central searchable database where you can type in any name, any university, academic, scientist, doctor, nurse, prescriber, social media influencer, and say, how much were they paid by the pharmaceutical industry or any industry, any device makers or corporate entities? So the UK is lagging. You know, normally we say, UK likes to say, oh, we're better than other bits of the world, and I won't name which other bits of the world. But in this case, we're doing crap. Yeah. So I'm afraid I want to be positive. I wanted to end with a positive note, but I don't think I can.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to do sometimes, but that's all right. Well,
best thing, Peter, just get on and live your life.
Yeah. Peter, thank you so much for coming on. I'm sure you'll be back again as you keep on sending me really great articles. Give your blog a shout out. I love it. And make sure people know how to find it.
Yeah, it's quite a complicated name, and don't be put off by the name. It's called Whole Uzi Up, which is, it's all one word. It's H for Harry, OLEOUSIA. If you just type that in, you'll get to my blog. And it basically means that it's not an alternative blog. It's not complementary medicine, anything like that. It's a blog that covers, my main aim is to combine arts and sciences issue topics in one blog. So that's essentially what Holusia means.
Mm-hmm. In what language?
It's Latin.
Latin. Okay, great. Yeah. All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming on. Have a lovely day. And,
thank you. Yeah, good to talk to you. Yeah. Okay, take care.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you want to see the full video interview, we also post these to YouTube. Just go to Wittering Psychiatry on YouTube to find those. You'll also find several YouTube exclusive videos from Drs. Yosef and Marissa posted several times a week. Finally, if you need help with your drug taper, getting a second opinion, or managing your post-acute withdrawal, come visit us at witduringpsychiatry.com. Our sole focus is on helping patients regain control of their lives and achieve optimal mental health on as little medications as possible.